This time on your weekly constitutional.
The Fourth Amendment protects against searches and seizures, and this term at the Supreme Court has a slew of interesting cases involving getaway motorcycles, rental car drug dealers, and cell phone location data. Can the police find out where you are at all times? It will be exciting.
That was James Stern of William & Mary's Law School telling us all about the current term of the Supreme Court and all the Fourth Amendment cases that are going to be decided there very soon. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about a Fourth Amendment update, 2018 edition.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Among my favorite books, and indeed my favorite movies, is 1984 by George Orwell, which posits a future dystopia that is the opposite of our constitutional order. In Orwell's world, set in a place called Oceania, there is no individual freedom, and there's certainly no right to prevent the government from invading your home, your car, even your person. The Fourth Amendment of our Constitution specifically protects us from that kind of government intrusion. And this year, there happened to be quite a few Fourth Amendment cases before the United States Supreme Court. I thought we'd have an update, and to do that, I called my buddy, James Stern. We spoke via Skype.
Well, my name is James Stern, and I'm a professor at the law school at William & Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. And I teach a variety of different classes, torts, property, intellectual property, and on top of that, I also write a bit about the Fourth Amendment, which is maybe more closely related than you might at first think.
Let's talk about the Fourth Amendment, because by golly, it seems like the Supreme Court has taken quite an interest in that particular part of the Constitution, hasn't it?
It is it's a perennial favorite, and this term has some really interesting and in some cases really potentially quite significant cases on the docket. Maybe the first one that would be
Before we do that, James, I always like to always start with the actual text of the document. Do you happen to have a copy of the Fourth Amendment there in front of you?
Well, I could probably recite it.
Okay, but, go ahead. Recite it so we all know where we're starting from.
But I will cheat. Okay. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
And that is
there you go, Amendment 4.
Profoundly important amendment that protects, broadly speaking, our privacy in our persons and our effects and all the rest of that stuff. Lots of deep roots in British constitutional law, lots of revolutionary roots with the colonists' resistance to those writs of assistance and those very broad warrants that were issued without any probable cause. So that's what we're talking about, and that's the subject of the Supreme Court this term, or at least several of the cases. So why don't you tell us about them?
Sure thing. Well, I thought I'd start with Collins versus Virginia, since I know you have a substantial Virginia listenership. Collins versus Virginia arose in Charlottesville. It involves a kind of a somewhat colorful set of facts. There was a guy out on the roads of Charlottesville who had a souped-up modified motorcycle. And he had been flagged for speeding a couple of times, but this thing was it was pretty fast. And on a couple of occasions, he actually managed to elude the police and get away from them.
That's rare.
I think at some level I didn't realize you could do. But motorcycles do go fast, and this was certainly one that did. But somehow the police, partly through an ill-advised Facebook post that this fellow Collins had posted, one of the police officers saw a picture of this motorcycle parked in front of his house. And so the police officer went to investigate the scene and went up to went up to the house and then proceeded to poke around the perimeter of the house and found what was in fact this motorcycle underneath a tarp by the side of the house. So not on the pathway up to the door, but off to the side. And this, none of this was done with a warrant. And so the question presented in the case has to do with the intersection of a couple of different Fourth Amendment principles. The Supreme Court has laid out a general rule, first of all, that whatever constitutes a Fourth Amendment search has to be is presumptively unreasonable unless it is accompanied by a warrant. There has to be a warrant that's issued ahead of time. But there is a general exception to that, referred to as the automobile exception, which relieves police of the need for a warrant where cars are concerned, and motorcycles, I should say, on a kind of twofold theory. One, that the if you have to stick around for to get a warrant, the car will be long gone. They are very mobile. And second, it said there's a diminished expectation of privacy that you have in a car that's out on the road. So that's the basic idea. That rule comes up against the general principle in Fourth Amendment law that the home is sacrosanct, that in general, nothing gets a surer protection than your home under Fourth Amendment law. And the requirements of probable cause and a warrant are particularly stringently asserted there. So here you've got the two rules kind of on a collision course with each other. And the question is whether the police can dispense with the ordinary warrant requirement as far as the real estate and house are concerned, because there is this motorcycle that's involved.
So this is really a question of whether this is more of a home search or more of a vehicle search.
When, of course, in a sense, it is both.
Right. And I'll just interject.
And on
here,
top of that, it's also a tarp search.
Tarp
it might
search.
Also be.
Okay. Well, it's you know, ever since 1967, the Supreme Court in the famous Katz case has focused upon, not exclusively, but to a great extent, on something you mentioned a moment ago, the expectations of privacy. What's a reasonable expectation of privacy? And as you point out, your home is the place where you can most reasonably expect to be private, and therefore it's going to get the greatest judicial scrutiny. Whereas, as you say, when you're out on the road in your car and you've got windows, or certainly a motorcycle, I mean, you're basically there for everybody to see. So much lower expectation of privacy. But this one is parked. It's covered with a tarp. It's in someone's yard. Are you going to talk about the concept of curtilage next?
I would be happy to.
Please do.
It's clear that, let me say, sort of two bookending principles. One is the house itself, the building, the structure, is considered to be at the heart of the Fourth Amendment. Another principle that's in play is that that which is, however sacrosanct the home may be, that which is visible on your private property to the general world is not your, that if you know, someone is walking by and just happens to observe that you're up to some nefarious deed in your living room, that is not going to be within that protection. So you've got sort of two different principles there. And a sort of a variant on the second one is that when the police have an otherwise lawful purpose to be on the property and they observe something in the course of doing that, the Fourth Amendment protection isn't going to be triggered in the same way.
Right, it's called the plain view doctrine. So just here's a little bit of free legal advice. If you're going to be torturing kittens, make sure you pull your blinds.
Yes, exactly.
Very important. Always do that. Yes, okay, good.
The curtilage principle is it sort of imagines that there is a perimeter around the house. There's some debate about just how strong this is, but the general idea is that the immediate environs around the house are treated as essentially equivalent to the house, subject to that caveat I mentioned before, which is that what you're, you know, obviously there's when you're out of doors, there's more that's visible in general to the outside world. But it receives the same kind of protection, in contradistinction to something, to a second doctrinal category, which they call the open fields, and you know, which is, I think, roughly designed to describe what it sounds like. General sort of, you might think of as wide open acreage rather than the sort of immediate parts of the land around a structure where you'd be coming and going and doing things as part of your, you know, residential life.
Okay, so we got three locations here. We've got your house, and your house has walls, and within those walls, the highest expectation of privacy. Immediately outside those walls, but close to them, maybe within sight or hearing of your windows, that sort of thing. We have the somewhat nebulous area called curtilage, where you may very well have a similar, very high expectation of privacy, with the caveat that if something's in plain view there, the police can look at it just like the general public can. And then if you go further out from the curtilage, and again, the border's somewhat nebulous, but imagine a farmhouse sitting in, you know, off by itself. You know, once you get outside the immediate yard outside the house and you're actually out in the tobacco fields, well, that's out in a field. Anybody can go and look out in a field, and especially if it's something that's just visible from the road or even from the air, you're going to have very little expectation of privacy out in the open field.
And what I would generally say is that in outside of a rural context, in modern life, there's actually, this is my interpretation, but I think it's right, there's actually very little open fields that actually exist, or that you know, there's not all that much going on so far as the open fields doctrine goes. So
in this case,
if you're living in a relatively compact suburban, let alone urban kind of setting, everything is either going to be the structure itself or its curtilage.
Okay.
With, you know, minimal exceptions.
Okay.
And so the question, you know, so one question is there exact parity between the curtilage and the interior of the house, or is there some play in the joints there? I think the general tendency is to say that they are treated as equivalent, but there's some uncertainty about that.
Yeah, in fact, the one case it reminded was not this term, but a couple of years ago was the dog sniffing case. I think, what was that, the Jardines, or what was it?
Jardines.
The Jardines case, where the cops, just like anybody else, can walk up to your door and knock on it, but can they bring drug-sniffing dogs right up onto your porch? And I believe the holding there was that they couldn't without a warrant.
Right, right.
Because the concept of curtilage, I mean, the only way that the dog could have smelled drugs was by getting up close to your house. And in fact, if you think of smoke drifting out of your house, that kind of also gives you an idea of the concept of curtilage, because you do want privacy. You don't want people coming up with drug-sniffing dogs right next to your house.
Right.
Okay.
And that's it. You know, to the extent it's a front porch, that's a little bit easier, but even your front yard is going to count. And the point is here, that's where the motorcycle was here. It wasn't inside the garage of the house, and it wasn't a display piece. This is one of the hypos that came up in the oral argument. This wasn't like Jay Leno or something with on a pedestal in the living room. But it's not clear that should matter. It probably, under standard Fourth Amendment doctrine, doesn't make any difference. That is to say, if it would be impermissible so far as the house is concerned, then that's probably true here as well.
Okay, so the cops really didn't know that it was the motorcycle they were looking for until a cop walked into the curtilage, onto the property, near the house, and actually lifted up the tarp, which had been placed there perhaps to conceal the motorcycle, perhaps just to conceal it from the weather, but nonetheless, it blocked the view of it. Oral argument was in January, I believe, right?
That's right.
And any sense on where they're going to announce their decision in June? Do you have any sense from the oral argument where they're going to come out on this one?
I'd say my sense here is I think that Collins will prevail. I think that the basic structure of what's happening here is, look, the automobile exception clears away any difficulty so far as searching a car is concerned, but it doesn't go beyond that. I suspect that that's sort of the analytical line that the court will follow. It dispenses with any problems in terms of searching the car, but not in terms of searching your property in order to find the car. It only takes care of the automobile part. And in fact, searching the car, there's very little, or here the motorcycle, there's actually very little searching of the motorcycle that takes place. There's the lifting of the cover, and there's the straying around to find this lump under the tarp. But that's as far as it goes. So I think for that reason, I think that's the sort of line that that the court will take. I don't expect it to be unanimous, but I would guess it will be more than 5-4.
Yeah, it's really more of a search for a motorcycle than a search of a motorcycle.
Right.
And since it was sitting there, and since the cop could have sat there and presumably could have called in or electronically requested a warrant, no reason he shouldn't have gotten one. Okay, that's maybe where we think the court's going to come out on
and,
that
And it's
one.
Interesting, just one last comment. Mm-hmm. There are these, this is a thing that comes up in Fourth Amendment law, fair deal. There are broad statements that are made that are maybe broader than they properly should be. So for all this time, it's thought, well, there just is this exception for automobiles, but actually it may be more limited than that, in the sense that it depends on the automobile being in a public place.
Yeah, I think, quite frankly, if the court goes this way and fines for the defendant, that could be generalized to a car that's sitting under a tarp. In a yard. It's the same basic concept. I mean, yeah, cars are mobile, but you know, once they're stopped or when they're parked, certainly they're not mobile at that moment. And quite frankly, if it's in your yard and it's covered, then you do have an expectation that it's going to stay covered and that it's your private property. Gonna find her. Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking via Skype with James Stern of William & Mary's Law School, and he's updating us on all the important developments going on in the Supreme Court involving the Fourth Amendment. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to return to our discussion with James Stern of William & Mary's Law School, who's telling us all about the important Fourth Amendment cases that are pending before the United States Supreme Court.
Well, the next one maybe to talk about is Byrd.
Tell us about the Byrd case.
Byrd involves a paradigm that may be more familiar to us than we might like to admit. First there's a woman who rented a rental car and then allowed her fiancé to drive it. And the rub is that he was not on the rental agreement and authorized to drive it, which is a problem, because the other rub is that he had a whole bunch of drugs in the trunk of the car.
Not the sort of guy you want to let drive your car. Just note to self, don't loan your car to those guys.
It's drug dealers do like to use rental cars in point of fact, or mm-hmm. so I've read. He gets stopped and the police conduct a search of the trunk and find all the drugs that are in there. And if this had been his fiancée who had been driving, there's no question that she would be able to claim an invasion of her reasonable expectation of privacy under conventional Fourth Amendment doctrine for this search. But the question is whether her fiancée can, given that he was not authorized to drive the car. And this is it's a nifty case, because if you look at it from one vantage point, it looks really strong for one side. And if you look at it from another vantage point, it looks very strong for another side. So
okay, James, before we get into that, let's go back a little bit, because I think I sense there's a bit of confusion out there. A moment ago, when we discussed the Collins case, we were talking about the automobile exception. But now we're talking about the need for the expectation of privacy in the trunk of a car. That's a little bit complicated. When you stop an automobile, the search doesn't necessarily include a locked trunk, does it?
Right. It doesn't extend as far as that. And the other thing is that the automobile exception is about the requirement of getting a warrant, but it isn't a blanket exemption from the Fourth Amendment altogether. It doesn't mean that you have no Fourth Amendment rights in your car, no Fourth Amendment right not to be searched. It means that the requirement of getting a warrant isn't triggered. But the Fourth Amendment does more than simply require a warrant. So even when that doesn't come into play, there's still the general requirement that the search not be unreasonable.
Right. And there's a distinction that's typically drawn between the passenger compartment, where the police certainly have a strong interest in searching to make sure there's going to be no contraband or destroyed or weapons that are available to the people in the car, and the trunk of the car, which is, at least in theory, secure.
Right. And this is, again, generally in Fourth Amendment law, this is a problem. It's actually in some ways similar to what we saw in Collins. The question is what the scope of a particular principle that allows a police officer to act, what the scope of that is. You know, does a search, does the right to, for example, seize you or search you extend to searching the bag that you're carrying? Does it extend to the car that you're driving and so forth? That is an extension that's at play here.
Okay, so the young woman in Bird who has a rental car and it's in her name would have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the trunk of the car. And so normally, if this just had involved her and the cops wanted to search the trunk and she said, no, I don't want you to do that, they would have had to go get a warrant based on probable cause to search the trunk. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So the question here is whether this fiancé, the young man, I'm assuming he's young, has a similar expectation of privacy in that trunk, leading to a similar requirement for a warrant based upon probable cause.
Well, and I should clarify, it's not really centrally about whether you need a warrant as such. It's even the real question is, does the Fourth Amendment even apply at all?
Okay.
Even if this were exempt from the warrant requirement, there's still the question whether there is probable cause to conduct the search. So, you know, there are various exceptions to the warrant requirement, the automobile exception, the exigency requirement exception. But that doesn't mean the Fourth Amendment doesn't kick in. It just means that the process of going and swearing out swearing out affidavits and getting a warrant, finding a magistrate, you don't have to do that. But you are still going to be scrutinized after the fact to make sure that the search was properly supported under the circumstances, even if it's an emergency.
Okay.
So that's what's at issue here. The question is whether Bird has a reasonable expectation of privacy at all, really in any part of the car, given that he was not on the rental agreement.
So is there some sort of either ownership or other legal control issue that kicks in the Fourth Amendment, or is it simply the fact that you're the driver, which is what Bird's arguing?
Well, so here's the thing. The Fourth Amendment, since the Katz case that you talked about, the central test in the inquiry has been whether what the police or other government officials have done has in some way violated your reasonable expectation of privacy. Those are the magic words. And the trouble is, if there's trouble, but I tend to think there is, reasonable expectation of privacy is, among other things, quite ambiguous. It could mean a bunch of different things. And so this is a case that brings some of those ambiguities out. When we say expectation, do we mean, or reasonable expectation, do we mean what you actually think is going to happen, or what people in general think is going to happen, or do we mean what you ought to be able to claim privacy in. Those are very different. So one is sort of predictive, and the other is much more kind of judgmental, you might say. When do you have a rightful claim that you not be searched? And how do we, if it's the latter, how do we judge that? Is that based on sort of prevailing sensibilities, or is that based on a kind of independent sort of moral analysis by whoever is adjudicating this dispute? All of that, there are these different meanings, and the Supreme Court sort of shifts between different ones at different times, and it's not really clear what it means. As a predictive matter, would this guy have thought that the knowledge of his, I think it's heroin, that his heroin payload was unknown to the world? Yeah, sure. It was, you know, it's shielded from view. Presumably there's a lock. Nobody could see that. Could he rightfully think that he is a sort of justified claim of privacy here? Well, that's a little different. That's where it becomes more uncertain, given his weird legal status. He's not a criminal. He's not a carjacker, but he's also not a proper sort of renter in the ordinary course. So it's hard to know exactly how that tracks.
But there's an analogy here, isn't there, to something that may be even more common than this, and that is that you're borrowing cars. I mean, has the court ever ruled on the idea that if I borrow a car from Wayne, my producer, who's sitting here with me, that I don't have any expectation of privacy in that car while I'm tootling around town in it?
I don't know that the Supreme Court has ruled on that.
It would seem to me, just as the driver, that I would feel like I would have exactly the same expectation of privacy I'd have in my own car, because ownership...
Well, the closer analog, I think, would be if you borrow Wayne's car and Wayne says, whatever you do, don't let Stern drive the car. And then you let Stern drive the car.
Okay, so to some extent, this fiancé really shouldn't have been driving then, because the rental company had not approved him as another driver.
Yes, although, okay. You know, just how strong an admonition there is not to do this is a little bit uncertain.
But that's a matter of contract law. Okay, I mean, so maybe, okay, he doesn't technically have the rental company's permission. That's an issue between him and the rental company. I don't know that that's necessarily something that should affect at all his relationship with the government.
Well, so there are two different slices on the case, and I think of all of the cases this term, this is the hardest one for me to predict how it comes out, because there's a certain sense in which you could say he had no lawful right to drive it. The owner of the car never authorized this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the case for the government, so to speak. He had now, on the other hand, there are a couple different ways to come at this. Justice Gorsuch had an interesting sort of analysis here, and I like it particularly because he alluded to an article that I'd written in the course of it, so I'm a little bit biased.
Did he mention name?
Yes.
He didn't allude to it, then he cited you. Oh, no, that must have been an exciting moment for you.
It was gratifying.
That was a call your mom moment. Okay, go on.
But the gist of the point, his analysis that he floated was to say, well, look, standard property principles, a possessor has, at least a possessor who's not a thief, has rights against all others who, unless they have a better title than he does. So the true owner may, trumps him, but so far as everybody else is concerned, the possessor, who's not, so long as it's not actually downright illegal or a thief, has rights that are good against the rest of the world. And so if that's the principle, and in a sense, that's sort of what Byrd's attorneys were arguing, or at least it partakes of that flavor. So long as an ordinary person couldn't do what was done here, then basic property principles suggest that there is, in fact, a legal basis for an expectation of privacy here, even though there is a kind of a defect or a flaw. He does not. The whole reason the case is there is because Byrd does not come in, does not come to the court standing in the very best possible light. But the question is, well, how bad is that light? And the sort of common law property answer is not that bad.
Not that bad. Yeah, exactly. Yep, property is a bundle of rights, and maybe he just didn't have every stick in the bundle.
I was walking down the street, minding my own affair, when two policemen grabbed me unaware. They says, your name Henry. I says, why, sure. He says, you the boy I've been looking for.
Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with James Stern, who teaches law at the College of William and Mary's Law School. And we're talking about this term at the Supreme Court as regards the Fourth Amendment. And now it's time to finish our discussion with James Stern of William and Mary, who's been telling us all about some really interesting Fourth Amendment cases currently in front of the United States Supreme Court. Previously, we talked about the Collins versus Virginia case, in which the police went onto someone's property and looked under a tarp to identify a motorcycle that had been speeding around town. We also heard about the Byrd case, which involved whether someone who wasn't actually authorized to be a driver in a rental car had any sort of Fourth Amendment rights to what was in the trunk of that rental car. Now we're going to talk about the biggest of them all, Carpenter.
The big blockbuster in Fourth Amendment law this term is a case called Carpenter. And the question in Carpenter, in some ways, it foreshadows a lot of things to come, but just so I'm not misunderstood, some of the technological questions here are sort of old-fashioned. The case, basically, the question presented is whether the Fourth Amendment applies when the police or law enforcement officials go to your cell phone company to find out where you have been, what your movements have been over a certain period of time. Now, it's not actually, the reason I said what I said before, it's not actually GPS data that's here. I don't know if that is an especially salient fact. This is a little bit more old-fashioned. It's sort of triangulation information about what cell towers you were your cell phone was logging onto or pinging with.
Let me see if I can explain the technical thing here. You correct me if I'm wrong, but essentially, you know, you've got cell towers. That's what your mobile phone is communicating with. Might be communicating with more than one at any given time. It's sending signals regularly back and forth. Maybe you'll switch from one tower to the other. Maybe your call will be dropped when you do, and maybe it won't be. But at any rate, the company has records of those. And by simply looking for your pings, and they can tell which towers you were near, and sometimes if there's more than one tower you were near at that time, they can actually do something called triangulating your position, especially if there are three towers, right down to a very GPS-like record of exactly where you were on an almost minute-by-minute basis, which has led at least one person to call cell phones tracking devices you can talk on.
And that's true in a bunch of contexts,
right.
As recent events have shown. It's not just about Fourth Amendment law, but in fact, Google and Facebook and so forth know a great deal of information about you and what you're up to.
So you thought you were being discreet going to your mistress's apartment, but not necessarily so. And we have to emphasize, this is regardless of whether you've got a GPS system on your cell phone. So this is something
right.
You might be entirely unaware of. You may never use Google Maps or MapQuest or anything like that. This is something the cell phone companies generate. And also, to be clear, we're not talking about your actual recorded conversations, even if such a record exists. We're simply talking about these locational things that the company has a legitimate reason for doing, making sure that it can transmit your signals, that as a byproduct, probably an unavoidable byproduct, create this electronic record of your moment-by-moment movements.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay, so can the cops get that from Verizon, for example, without getting a warrant?
And not just without getting a warrant, but without any Fourth Amendment protection whatsoever. So, though the warrant is going to be the kind of salient piece here.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's an older case involving traditional telephones where there were similar records made by phone companies. It was called a pen register. And those records were held under something called the third party doctrine. That is, the third party was holding those records, the phone company, to not be subject to the Fourth Amendment. Was that correct?
That's right. So
I forget. What was the name of it? Was that the Riley case?
There's Smith and Miller.
Smith and Miller, right.
The two big cases.
Right.
On the that sort of set this in motion.
Right.
So the deal is this. You may have been, it may surprise your average phone user to learn that that there might not be any constitutional constraint whatsoever on the ability to demand your location information from a cell phone provider. In fact, from these cases, Smith and Miller, the court articulated or developed a doctrine or a rule called the third party doctrine. And the principle of the third party doctrine is that information that's voluntarily disclosed to a third party presents no reasonable expectation of a privacy that you can assert when, this is an important caveat that's often left out, when the government learns this information from the third party. So it's not just that any conversation you have with someone else is automatically carved out from the Fourth Amendment, but it is to the extent that the person you are speaking with divulges what was said. That's the kind of foundation of it. But from there, it's extended in these cases, Miller and Smith, to various kinds of records, to records of whom you dial on the telephone. And that's what the pen register is about. The pen register is this doohickey, basically, that it was a machine that you would install at phone company headquarters, and it would record in pre-touchstone days the clicking that would be used by the telephone exchange to connect you to whomever you're dialing. So basically what it does is it records the numbers that you're calling to reach someone. And the other case involves bank records, and the Supreme Court says, well, look, when you divulge information to the bank, and then we get this information from the bank, you're out of luck. The Fourth Amendment doesn't apply there because when you have voluntarily disclosed this information to the bank, you have no expectation of privacy insofar as disclosure from the bank, insofar as that's concerned. So if we learn about it from the bank, you have no expectation of privacy.
Those cases have been around for a while. And so that's what they're arguing. The government is saying this is just like a pen register. This is just like bank records. We just went to Verizon. We just asked them about the pings. We want to know when Harris's car, or in this case, Carpenter's car, where it was, or Carpenter himself. We want to know what your ping information, because Carpenter willingly and voluntarily disclosed that to the phone company, so he's got no expectation of privacy in it.
Now, there are different – the counsel for Mr. Carpenter raised various grounds on which to try and distinguish this from the classic sort of third-party paradigm. There are a good lawyer can always draw some distinction between any two different cases, even if it's just that was a Tuesday and this is a Wednesday. But for the most part, at least in terms of anything that was sort of a clear analytic distinction, my own take is that it was very difficult to do that. There's a kind of fuzzier distinction that might be drawn to say, well, this is in some sense much more invasive than the bank account records or doctor's records or whatever. But in some sense, I'm not even sure that that is true. But it certainly raises the specter in the minds of a lot of people of a kind of surveillance state.
Yeah. You know, sort of 1984-ish.
We live in an era in which we voluntarily store information with other people. We voluntarily transmit information through, you know, telephone lines and so forth to other people all the time. Lots of people have lots of very private records about us that are, you know, that people certainly in a predictive sense expect will not be disclosed or divulged to the world. And so
there are exceptions to the third party doctrine. I mean, I can't just because I divulge my medical information to my doctor doesn't mean the government can necessarily go in and get my medical reports.
It generally does.
The government can simply go into my doctor's office and get my latest.
There are non-constitutional subpoena requirements, but the general principle is information that you voluntarily divulged when obtained from the third party. That's it.
Okay, so there are only statutory protections for that information, like HIPAA.
Right.
Okay.
And more pertinent here, statutory requirements about, you know, just what under what circumstances you can issue a subpoena and that sort of thing. And of course, the doctor will have some Fourth Amendment rights, him or herself, and you know, is not going to take a search of their offices lying down.
But it wouldn't be my Fourth Amendment rights. It would be the doctor's Fourth Amendment rights.
Right.
Very
right.
Interesting. You're teaching me something here today, James. Okay, let's try to wrap.
So for that reason, So two things. One, the doctrine has long been criticized. But two, the argument is made not only are the traditional criticisms quite forceful, but in this technological age we're living in, it really needs to be reconsidered.
Yeah, and in fact, wasn't it just a couple of years ago when the cops put essentially a GPS tracking type system, clandestinely they put it on a guy's car. They made the argument that under existing precedent, that was just like them following him around. He had no expectation of privacy. He was out in the public driving in his car. So if the cops could follow him visually, why couldn't they follow him electronically? And the court basically recoiled from that. And I think they did it on the basis you just mentioned. Wait a second. Do we really want to live in a society where the cops can simply know where we are 24/7?
Well, and they drew a line that's not really responsive to the concern to the concern about all pervasive surveillance. They said, well, look, at least the opinion for the court by Justice Scalia says, look, you installed this thing on the car, and that makes all the difference in the world. It wasn't that you were just following him around, but you actually attached this thing to the car.
Committed a trespass. Yeah,
right.
And that's we probably don't need to go into a lot of detail here. There are two basic strains here. There's the expectation of privacy cat strain, and then there's the property property rights strain that you actually, if you invade someone's property, that is going to make a Fourth Amendment violation that much more egregious or be the basis actually for applying the Fourth Amendment to it. So those were both present. And remind me of the name of that case, the GPS tracker case.
That's Jones.
That's the Jones case. Okay.
Jones.
Sorry, my memory's failing me here. Okay. I'm actually thinking, I'll go out on a limb here, I'm thinking the court might build upon Jones to find for Carpenter. What do you think about that?
Well, I would be, in some sense, all for that. I think that's going to be harder to do here. Justice Gorsuch, again, we got a certain nod in oral argument here. Justice Gorsuch wants to do something in a property-like vein. The rest of the court seems a little bit more skeptical of that. So it will be interesting to see how that goes. The property offers a kind of a doctrinal clarity. If you want to just nail this down, you say, well, look, you can't, this is my stuff. And the rules here can kind of lay out a good framework for us. If you don't do that, you end up with something that's a little bit more open-ended. But I suspect that's the direction the court will probably go. I think that there will be a majority that, on one ground or another, finds for Carpenter. It will certainly not be unanimous. I think Carpenter will prevail. I suspect the bulk of the justices who side in his favor are going to go for something that's more holistic in terms of the analysis, to say something like, this is different from the traditional third party doctrine cases. The level of intrusion here, the potential for surveillance of every aspect of your life is too great. So in this case, they surveilled him for 127 days. That's they just know every, in a sense, every place he was over that period of time. The court will probably say, well, that just somehow goes too far. That's my guess.
We'll just call it the Orwell doctrine. This is just too darn Orwellian.
Something like that, I think. That's
all
probably right.
Right. Well, James Stern of the Law School at the College of William and Mary, thank you so very, very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
We really and truly enjoy it. And let us know. Maybe we'll talk again after the court comes out with these cases.
I am certainly excited to see what happens.
And now it's time for our constitutional quiz, recorded before a live audience at the 2018 State Championships in Virginia of the We the People competition. Assisting me are Stephanie Heshen and the quiz gal, Meg Hubeck of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia.
We
yes.
need one more boy, girl, or young lady and young gentleman team.
Yeah.
Oh, they make a cute couple too, don't they?
Oh,
yes,
another
lovely.
Cute couple. All righty here.
Okay.
Who do we have?
I'm Jordan Gooding from Glen Allen High School. I'm a senior.
And Patrick Wright from Glen Allen.
Yay!
Wait a second. You're not from the same school?
Yeah.
You are from the same school?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. Okay.
Glen Allen.
All right.
Glen Allen.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
How well do you know the signers of the Constitution?
Yes.
You know them? Yes. Okay. All right.
I have no idea. So you're.
So here's the question, the last one for today. Which of the following did not sign the Constitution?
Oh, crap.
A, Benjamin Franklin. B, Patrick Henry.
Oh, my man signed
C, James Madison.
He obviously signed it.
D, George Mason.
He signed it.
E, John Dickinson. Which did not sign the Constitution.
George Mason?
Are you?
That's Ben Franklin.
George Mason's like, are you all you're one.
Okay. You know for sure.
Okay.
You gotta say it in unison.
One, two.
I don't know what the name
George
is.
George Mason. One, two, three.
George Mason.
Ben
Franklin. Ben Franklin.
In fact, okay. George Mason is often referred to as the father of the Bill of Rights.
You know, Meg, wait a second. Wait. We got a little confusion here. The judges are reconsidering.
Oh,
A. Ben Franklin.
George Mason is, in fact, often considered to be a great contributor to the Bill of Rights, but I think we got our facts a little bit mixed up. George Mason actually stomped out of the Constitutional Convention and refused to sign. So there are two actually correct answers here.
So you got it right. Sorry.
Okay, just a second. Wait. But wait a second. Here's bonus points. Who's the other person on this list? Stop the dancing now. No dancing until you're finished. Okay. Who's the other person on that list who did not sign?
The other person that didn't sign.
Is it one of the choices?
Ben Franklin or
Patrick Henry?
Are you sure?
If he signed it?
Patrick Henry.
Who was the other guy, Dickinson? He signed it.
I feel like he did sign it.
All right.
Patrick Henry.
He smelled the rat.
Probably...
Now, there's a story here. Now, the reason we got a little bit confused up here is because George Mason is properly credited as one of those people who's most responsible for us having a Bill of Rights. But the story goes that in September of 1787, when the Constitutional Convention was drawing to a close, a lot of people just wanted to go home. And a lot of other people, including James Madison were opposed to the idea of a Bill of Rights for a variety of reasons. George Mason was so upset that there was no Bill of Rights that he just got on his horse and rode home. Patrick Henry, on the other hand, had been against this Constitution pretty much from the time he learned about it.
Yeah, he's...
And so he's a much easier one to pick in terms of not signing. I encourage you, if ever you get the chance, to go to the National Archives in Washington, D.C. and see the signed copy of the Constitution, which is in tremendous, wonderful shape. But when you go there, don't do what I did. I was standing with my nose pressed so close to the glass that the security guard said, sir, step away from the Constitution. Step. They are so protective of that thing. It's encased in a high-tech glass case, sealed and filled with argon.
Argon.
And every night when the National Archives close, they turn a key, and the Constitution lowers like a James Bond movie into a steel vault designed to resist a thermonuclear explosion. So after we're all dead and the cockroaches take over, they will know how to govern themselves. Okay, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
James Madison is widely recognized for his accomplishments as a statesman. But what kind of father was the father of the Constitution? Although he never sired a child of his own, Madison adopted his stepson, John Payne Todd, at the age of 2, upon marrying Dolly in 1794. Despite his esteemed parentage, Payne never amounted to anything more than a profligate, prone to gambling, alcoholism, and depression. Worried Payne was locked up in debtor's prison, Madison wrote a letter in 1825, urging him to make his whereabouts known. What shall I say to you? It is painful to utter reproaches, yet how can they be avoided? Your last letter to your mother made us confident that we should see you in a few days. Weeks have passed without even a line explaining the disappointment or soothing the anxieties of the tenderest of mothers. I must not conclude without imploring and conjuring you to hasten to the embraces of your parents and to put an end to the uncertainties that afflict them. Your affectionate father, J. Madison. I'm Matt Dara, speaking to you from the Potter Studios at Montpelier with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our guest, James Stern of the William & Mary School of Law, who told us all about very important cases pending before the Supreme Court on the Fourth Amendment. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephant. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.